Welcome to Should I Love This Comic? My name is Damien Drewe-Whiter, and I'm here with...
Irrigail Drewe-Whiter.
To once again record a new episode of Should I Love This Comic? The podcast where we go through my comic book collection and I try to convince Irrigail that they should be loved.
Indeed.
And occasionally he agrees with me.
Sometimes.
Now, today we're going to look at a comic book from 1986. It's cover dated March 1986. It actually went on sale November 26, 1985, so it's actually a bit older than that, and it's New Mutants number 37, and it's called If I Should Die.
Spooky.
Now, this comic book is written by Chris Claremont. The artists are Mary Wilshire and Bill Sienkiewicz. The letterers are Tom Orzechowski and Lois Buchalis, and the colorist is Glynis Oliver. It's edited by Ann Nocenti, and the cover is by Rick Leonardi and Bill Sienkiewicz. So should we start with the cover?
Yep, let's...
Let's have a look at the cover. So I've got it here in front of me. I have my copy. My copy is a special version because it has a little change. Where there was a Secret Wars 2 flash on the side of it to tell you that this is a crossover, had fallen off, had got damaged. So somebody has very helpfully written in felt tip pen that it's a Secret Wars 2 crossover in the UPC box. You will see this if you look at the images that I share on shouldilovethis.blogspot.com. So this cover by Rick Leonardi and Bill Sienkiewicz. What do you think of it, darling?
I quite like it.
I love it. I think it's really great. Yeah. It's really impactful. It is the Beyonder sat on a pile of bodies formed of various members of the New Mutants. Mm-hmm. He's holding Rain by her neck and strangling her to death, seemingly. Mm-hmm. And he's being attacked by Magma and Cannonball. And we can see in the background Warlock and Mirage getting ready to attack. But he's almost like nonchalant. He's not really noticing. Mm-hmm. I really like this. Rick Leonardi is probably my favourite comic book artist, definitely of this era. Mm-hmm. So that is part of that. Mm-hmm. But it's also, I think it's coloured really well. I think the fact that they've used a really saturated blue on the costume of, well, the outfit, it's a suit really that the Beyonder's wearing, and the background's green, and the costumes of the New Mutants feature yellow and their power signatures are in yellow, so you've got that kind of green, blue, yellow as a contrast around it, and it really makes him stand out and draws your attention. Anything you want to say?
What do I want to say? Yeah, I like the Beyonder's stance, I think. I think there's very much... There's something... The suit's well drawn, I think.
One of the talents of Rick Leonardi as an artist, and actually Bill Sienkiewicz as well, is inking it. Both of them are very good at drawing people in clothes, which is something a lot of superhero artists are not very good at. They can draw people in superhero costumes, but, you know, real world stuff like clothing, sometimes furniture in rooms and stuff. And that was a talent of both Bill Sienkiewicz and Rick Leonardi. Rick Leonardi in particular, very good at drawing clothing. And it's very 80s, isn't it? He's definitely wearing an 80s suit. That is not a suit from the 70s. No. And that is something, you know, again, there are certain comics artists who draw a suit the way they learned to draw a suit, and they draw it the same for forever. You know, a perfect example, actually, I was looking at some of his work recently, reading a comic drawn by him, is Steve Ditko, who co-created Spider-Man. And his first comic work was in like the early 60s. And all the way through his career, right up to stuff he was drawing like a couple of years ago, just before he died, clothes looked the same. He never moved the clothes on. He wasn't looking. Whereas I think Rick Leonardi and Bill Sienkiewicz, they were both young in the 80s, but I think they've both managed throughout their career to keep that attention to modern clothing, to modern design within their work. I think that's something they're both very good at, which really makes that stand out. Particularly, you know, the Beyonder was always drawn wearing like normal clothes in a way. A lot of the time he was wearing jumpsuits, actually.
Oh, okay.
And apparently the influence for that was actually Bill Sienkiewicz himself, who was quite kind of funky and fashionable. He was involved in the art, like he was involved with other artists, not just comic artists. And he was really quite a fashionable man. And apparently they copied his style from one of the artists of this book.
Oh, okay.
So that's interesting that they've used him there.
I think it's kind of questionable the
He's sitting on is a bit blurry,
and also the bodies that he's stamped on, although if you look closely there's legs and
kind of fits in, but there is also a it's like doesn't work. They're using the black of the costume to create a void that he's sat on, but there isn't really a seat there in some ways.
No.
They're slightly fooling you, which sometimes is what art does.
It's fine, but it's...
Yeah. I really like it.
Maybe it makes you look harder to try and work out what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I love this cover. It was my first issue of New Mutants. I got it as a back issue, but I got it before I got any contemporary issues. So New Mutants, weirdly, when I first started reading comics, buying them myself off the newsagents, the first few months I was buying comics, I didn't see the New Mutants. They weren't around. So I picked this up. Well, I bought it off a friend, actually, from school, who I gave him cover price for it, the 40p. I know. Daylight robbery. You know, a cheap comic nowadays costs £3.99.
I saw you coming.
Yeah. Let's go through my normal stuff. So we've agreed we love this cover.
Yep.
Yeah, we love this cover. Very, very good. Let's do my normal thing. So what I do in every single one of these episodes, if you're new to us, is I start by going into a deep dive into the creators of the comic we're focusing on. But actually, through the series that we've been doing, I have already covered a number of the people who were involved in New Mutants 37. So I discussed the writer Chris Claremont and the editor Ann Nocenti in episode 2, where we looked at Marvel Fanfare number 40, which had two stories in it, one written by Chris Claremont, one written by Ann Nocenti. And I did discuss Tom Orzechowski and Lois Buchalis in our most recent episode, which was number 8, which is about the Comico Christmas special, because they lettered, well, Lois Buchalis lettered one of the stories, but I talked about how she works with her husband, Tom Orzechowski, and I actually said quite a bit about his career as well. So I feel like I don't have to go into detail on those people because I have already. Is that okay with you, darling?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
So what I'm going to focus on is I'm going to focus on the artist. That's Mary Wilshire, and I don't know if it's Wilshire or Wilshire. I'm saying Wilshire.
Wiltshire.
But it could be pronounced Wilshire, like Wiltshire the place, but it hasn't got the T in it. I don't know. And the inker Bill Sienkiewicz, which is how you pronounce it. I know that for sure, but I keep saying it wrong.
Good.
And the colorist Glynis Oliver as the people I want to cover. So talking about their careers. So let's start with Mary Wilshire. She is a graduate of New York's Pratt Institute. Her earliest published story was in Wet Satin number 2 in 1978. And she started working for Marvel in their Crazy magazine, which was kind of the Marvel equivalent to Mad magazine. And she was a regular contributor to that. This led to her drawing Conan stories and becoming the artist of the 1983 launching Red Sonja series. Now, I mean, this happened because the editor of Crazy was Larry Hammer, who's a very famous Marvel Comics editor and creator, who... He also, as well as doing Crazy, which is like their version of Mad, he also edited all the Conan and Red Sonja comics. And amongst these, she also drew the adaptation of the Red Sonja movie. She was working on it at that time. Wilshire was one of the artists on the Spider-Man and Power Pack comic, co-produced between Marvel and the National Committee for Prevention of Child Abuse as well. From there, she moved to New Mutants. So she'd done some Red Sonja, she'd done some comedy stuff. She'd been involved in this one weird issue that's about child abuse to try and get... it was like a special comic that was given away free to school children to get encourage them to talk about it.
Okay.
And from there, she moved to New Mutants. Now, she was announced as the regular artist on New Mutants, but actually only drew three issues, and this one is her last. And then she moved on to the Firestar Limited series. Now, we know Firestar from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
We do.
And that was the series that took the cartoon character and put her in the Marvel Universe properly. Mm-hmm. Between 1987 and 1991, she drew almost nothing in the mainstream comics. My understanding is that she continues to draw comics, but not the ones that get indexed on comics websites. She's somebody who's quite difficult to find information about because she's worked on a lot of comics that are kind of either underground or semi-underground or things from smaller publishers. And most of the indexes you get is Marvel, it's DC, and it's companies that are trying to reach into the Marvel and DC crowd. So like last time we were talking about Comico, there's companies like Dark Horse, Eclipse, Image eventually. But I think she was always doing comics. She definitely contributed to some issues of women's comics, which is spelled W-I-M-M-I-N-S. And I believe she also did some work for National Lampoon magazine. I have tried to find out what she did, and I just can't find it. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have her own website. There's very little information about her out there. In 1991, she did come back to Marvel, and she actually drew most of Barbie number one. Marvel got the kind of license to print Barbie comics.
Okay.
And actually, she drew Barbie stories for the entire five-year run of Barbie comic books. So if you look at the Barbie comics, she's got a story, well, she does more than one story in Barbie number one. And the last issue of that series, before they lose the license, she's also got a story in. During this time, she also drew two issues of a comic that was just called The Life of Christ, which was co-published by Marvel and the Christian publisher Nelson. One was called The Christmas Story, which obviously was the Nativity. Mm-hmm. And the other one was called The Easter Story, which is appropriate as we're recording this over Easter.
Uh-huh.
And both of these were written by the writer she worked with on Red Sonja and Power Pack, which was Louise Simonson, who we've talked about a bit before. She also drew issues of Marvel's version of Disney's Little Mermaid. So for a brief period in the 90s, Marvel did Disney comics, weirdly, even though Disney has. This was before Disney owned Marvel. So after a 90s run for Marvel, Wilshire moved into illustration more, mainly working on children's books. In 2006, she illustrated the award-winning biography Fat Free, Amazing Ultra Adventures of Supersized Woman, which was written by Jude Milner. Mary Wilshire's art is defined by its humanity. Now, what I think stands out, and I think what she does well in this issue, is she gets people. She draws people well. She depicts sensitive, real people grounded in lived-in spaces, and is particularly good at expressive body language. I find her work joyful, even in a dark story like the one we're covering today, and this is a very dark story. So, yeah, she's a great artist. She's worked in lots of different forms. She's done fully painted stuff, pencils and ink. Great artist. The ink has stroke co-artists because they're credited as artists, and I feel like Bill Sienkiewicz was adding a lot to Mary Wilshire in this particular story. Was one of the top comics artists of the 80s and is still considered as a great comics artist today. Bill got his start in comics drawing Moon Knight backups in the Black and White Hulk comic in 1979 when he was just 19 years old. His early work was heavily influenced by the then top artist Neil Adams. Through 1981, he was penciling two books a month, Moon Knight and Fantastic Four, both of which were written by Doug Mensch, who was a big comics writer, did a lot of work through the 70s, 80s and 90s, long runs with Marvel, and then he went to DC and did a lot of work on Batman. So he had two big runs on Batman. In mid-1981, he left Fantastic Four and started both penciling and inking Moon Knight. During this run, he moved away from that Neil Adams style that he was drawing in and created a more experimental style. He combined ultra realism with pure cartooning and scratchy yet bold blacks. During the same period, he drew more and more covers for Marvel, including some stunning painted covers. So he became known as someone who could paint as well as draw, which in comics is quite unusual. A lot of the artists are more about black and white line art, particularly in the 80s, where it was very much about the kind of conveyor belt assembly line thing, where one person pencils, another person inks, another person colours, another person letters, you know, that things were going through stages, and he became like a full artist in many ways. In 1984, he became the artist on New Mutants, and he drew issues 18 to 31, and then came back and inked issues 35 to 38, which obviously include this issue, 37. He also drew the Marvel Comics adaptation of David Lynch's Dune movie. In 1986, so immediately following this, Bill produced two of his most famous works. One was the Marvel graphic novel Daredevil, Love and War, and he also did the Elektra Assassin series, which was, both of these were fully painted works. They're both full colour, and both were written by Frank Miller. They were also printed on better paper than normal comic books. You know, the kind of newsprint this one's published on meant that you couldn't necessarily do detail, whereas, you know, he could then do work at a... He could involve things that you just couldn't. You know, he used a lot of collage, a lot of texture, a lot of paint, obviously, and ink, and really playing around with it. And actually, these projects probably made fully painted comics fashionable, but few of them were able to maintain the spontaneity of line art in their painted art. So a lot of comics artists, when they paint a comic page, it loses something, because comics are about storytelling. They're about using the line to move and things to be moving and action. And quite often once people paint, things become a lot more frozen in time. And a lot of painted comic artists, you get like a series of paintings, which may be beautiful, maybe well done, but you can lose something. You lose some of the spontaneity. And something that he's very good at is really getting spontaneity and action and movement into an image. You know, and it doesn't seem to matter what medium he's using. So like his modern work, he does most of it in the computer. You know, he's working on the computer. And when he shares online, he'll share like original art. It'll be like a little scrap of paper where he's drawn a couple of things. And then he scans it and plays with it and turns it into what's on the comic book page. And he doesn't have all the panels on one page and a piece of art. It's individual bits of paper. But he can still create that. Again, some people using computers, it makes it more static. And he's very good at actually avoiding that. So he followed the two projects that I was talking about. So he followed Daredevil, Love and War and Elektra Assassin with a six-issue reboot of the classic character The Shadow for DC Comics. Probably more important for his creative career, the surrealistic limited series Stray Toasters that he both wrote and painted. Since the late 80s, Sienkiewicz has primarily worked outside comics as an illustrator, but has continued to produce covers and occasionally ink projects for Marvel and DC. Most recently, he's been inking Dennis Cowan on the Question limited series, The Deaths of Vic Sage. I would recommend following him online. He's a really great person to follow. I follow him on Twitter. I know he does share the same stuff to Facebook as well, but I would recommend following him as he frequently shares his latest illustrations and they are stunning. One of the things he's been doing, which sadly he's been doing quite often, is he does illustrations of people who've recently died. And because he's very good at likenesses, but he's also got an interpretive style. He does really beautiful things that reflect the person. One that sticks out in my mind, which was actually, I think over a year now, was when Chadwick Boseman died. The one that he shared for that, who obviously was someone who was related to comics. It just really was a stunning piece of artwork. And he's done it, you know, for lots of people. Really beautiful work. So let's move on to the colourist. That's Glynis Oliver, who got her first credit in Marvel's Avengers 107 in 1972. Now, this is probably not her first work, because 1972 is the first time that Marvel Comics credited colorists.
Mm.
So she got a credit in Avengers on the first issue that got a colorist credit, which was probably coloring it before that. And at the time, she was married to editor Len Wein, editor and writer Len Wein. So she was credited as Glynis Wein, who was working for Marvel, and she probably did color a lot of stuff under him. Yeah, so it's entirely possible that she'd been working uncredited before that, and I suspect she was. Mike's Amazing World, which I refer to a lot, is a great website for finding out who did what. They credit her with nearly 32,000 pages in her career, of which nearly 31,000 were for Marvel. So the vast majority of her work was for Marvel, and she worked for them until 2001. She is probably best known for her work on X-Men. She coloured the X-Men from its 1974 relaunch until 1991. So that's a really long run. And she also coloured most of New Mutants. She did most of the 100 issues of that, and also Excalibur, which were both spin-offs from that. You know, she coloured early issues of Wolverine. She did, you know, basically, if it was X-Men in the 80s, she coloured it. But she did lots of other stuff as well. The technique I most associate with her is monochrome, which I think we see a lot in this issue. I think I pointed it out to you a couple of times when we were looking at it before recording. She will often reduce a page to shades of one color, which achieves subtlety in an era where technology made this difficult. So nowadays, a color artist can create subtlety, can make something moody by using, you know, subtle shades, but using lots of different colors. You know, at the time when she was coloring, they only had something like 60 colours they could use. And that's 60 shades, not just 60 colours. And the way to create subtlety was to use different shades of one colour to really push that. And it's something she did very well. A perfect example of that would be page 6 of this issue, which I will share if you have a look on Should I love this? You see, I'm making your error. Should I love this.blogspot.com. And that's page 6 on the left there.
Okay.
Absolutely stunning, where she's basically using shades of blue and purple to create a mood and to really actually draw your attention to the action. Her best work is probably seen in the few graphic novels and special editions she worked on. Because those projects during the 80s, they were able to use what they called full process colour, which effectively means she painted and what she painted was what was published. So it went outside of the technical limitations of a newsstand comic. So if you look at things like the New Mutants graphic novel, and particularly for me, a much later comic that she comes after this one, there's a special edition that launched Excalibur called The Sword is Drawn, where she's actually painting with watercolours, and you can see what she is capable of in colour. You know, she does fantastic work with limitations, but once you take them away, you can really see where she could have gone. And let's finally quickly cover the cover artists. I'm not going to go through everything, but Rick Leonardi is my favourite comics artist. So he's someone I find it really difficult to be objective about his work because it gets me. You know, he's someone who, there's something about his art that just goes straight into me. I think I first saw his art in Uncanny X-Men 212, which was my second issue of X-Men. And then very soon after that, I got this comic as a back issue, which he did the cover for. And in that era, you know, he's doing Spider-Man, he did a lot of guesting. He's probably most famous initially for Cloak and Dagger. He drew the Cloak and Dagger limited series, and he was the artist for the first 5 or 6 issues of the Cloak and Dagger ongoing series, which only actually lasted 12 issues. And then he started doing a lot of fill-ins, a lot for the X-Men books throughout the late 80s and early 90s. And then, like, the first regular thing that I bought him doing was Spider-Man 2099, which is amazing. Really good work. He's just a really great artist. And I'm not going to go into too much detail because I'm sure at some point I will pick a comic that is drawn by him. And we will talk about that. And actually, I know that I am going to very soon, we're going to cover one because we know what we're doing after New Mutants, after this issue. And it does include a comic that he drew.
So can you describe, so maybe this is the wrong pip, but we can slice it.
It could be. We're talking about the cover in a way. And so you're talking about Rick Leonardi.
Yeah. So let's talk about the robot who I can't remember the name of.
Warlock.
Warlock. In this picture, he appears...
he appears slightly human.
There appears to be a lady in... Or a man.
Yeah, it is. Suit. It's a boy. It's Cypher or Doug Ramsey.
Okay.
So within within the New Mutants comics, Doug Ramsey has his power is that he can interpret or speak any language.
Okay.
So his power is languages, which obviously is not an offensive power.
Mm-hmm.
Warlock can turn into anything. He's like a robotic character. It's called techno-organic, they call it, that he's made of. And he can turn into any shape, any form. And at various points, he turns into spaceships that the characters use, or cars, or tanks. And one of the things they did throughout the comics, starting quite recently to this, is quite often Doug and Warlock would merge. And they become one being. So on the cover, Doug is effectively wearing Warlock as a suit of armour. And you can actually see the person there, but then above, there is another face. Because you've got the face of Warlock. Can you see the two eyes with the eyebrows on the mouth?
Yeah, that's why I was wondering.
Yeah, but it does look as though maybe Warlock has a human side. There are stories as well. Warlock can appear human. He can completely change his look. He doesn't have to be in this robotic kind of black and yellow form. He can appear exactly like a human being.
Okay.
And that does happen. He finds it hard to maintain that form, but he can do it. So he's a weird character. And he's a character that doesn't get that much focus in this issue.
No.
And it's quite difficult to know what he is. And, you know... Chris Claremont, I mean, we need to talk about the issue and the what happens in the story and stuff. That is one of the things that we cover in this.
Yeah.
I think one of Chris Claremont's things is he tends to focus on one or two characters in a story. Because he tends to have huge casts. He likes using huge casts. I think it keeps it interesting for him that he does a story about one or another. But basically... Throughout its existence, New Mutants, particularly when Chris Claremont writes it, he writes the first 54 issues, and then Louise Simonson takes over, who had edited the first few issues. He basically is either focusing on Danny Moonstar, who's known as Mirage. So this issue definitely focuses on Danny. Or he's focusing on Ilyana Rasputin, who is magic. She's the demon sorceress one. So they're his two key characters, and he tends to do that. And what this means is if you come in and read one of his stories, there are a lot of characters in the background, and he'll tell you some stuff about them. And he always gives them a little bit of stuff to do, or a little bit of a moment, or something revelatory about their character. But they're very much in the background. So this story, I would say Doug, Warlock, Rain, who's Wolfsbane, Karma, are very much in the background. Ilyana, Sam, who's Cannonball, Amara, who is Magma, get a little bit to do, but they're still in the background. And actually, the story is focused on Danny. You know, I think that's definitely true. And it's something he does. And I think it might be to blame for. If you were to ask me who my favourite New Mutant is, I would say it's Danny. This was my first issue of New Mutants. It's about her. A lot of the issues of New Mutants written by Chris Claremont are about her. Probably my second favourite character is Illyana Magic, who most of the other stories are about. You know, my favourite X-Man is Storm, and a lot of the X-Men books at that time are really about Storm, and the other characters come in and out. You know, he does this a lot, and he gives them things to do, but you can lose who is Doug, particularly on a first read. But I think what this does, and we'll talk about this more once we've gone through the synopsis, I think this gives you so much about Danny, and you care about her and you're interested that you want to come back to the book. And the fact that some of the other characters are a bit more hazy, it doesn't matter. You've fallen in love with that character. And, you know, at various points he does stories that do focus on those other characters, but they're always a one-off thing. You know, the big focus is Danny. Or Illyana, I would say. But yeah, in this issue, certain characters are definitely more in the background, even if they're right at the front. And actually, I've said Danny is the focus. You've got the comic open there on the first page. She's not on the first page. In fact, she's the only one of the characters who isn't on the first page. So let's go through my little synopsis for New Mutants 37, If I Should Die.
Hey you! Don't watch that! Watch this! This is the heavy, heavy monster sound! The nuttiest sound around! So if you're coming off the street and you're beginning to feel the heat, well listen, Buster, you better start to move your feet to the rockinest, rock steady beat of madness! One step beyond!
The New Mutants are home alone in the Xavier School. They're watching a cowboy movie and eating popcorn. Some of the kids are acting out the action, but Rain is concerned that Danny might be upset as she is Native American. Danny is on the phone to her mum and is thinking about how she recently went to Asgard and became a Valkyrie. She gasps as she sees personalised visions of death over the heads of all the New Mutants. She runs away and catches sight of herself in the mirror. She can see herself in her Valkyrie uniform, and then the reflection turns into Hela, the Norse goddess of death, who tells her, or reminds her, that she can see impending death. Danny runs to the barn, jumps on her flying horse Brightwind, and flies away. She sees an image projected in the sky of her talking to her grandfather. He is telling her about the history of her people, the Cheyenne, and how a man of honour may touch a foe rather than killing him. Sam flies through the illusion to check Danny is okay and she returns home. We cut to Midtown Manhattan where Bobby DaCosta, also known as Sunspot, is stuck in a traffic jam. He sees a fallen crane is blocking the road and offers to help. He goes in to play hero but is only able to brace the crane, not fully lift it. Just as he thinks he's going to drop it, along comes She-Hulk, who easily picks it up and saves the day. Bobby is feeling sorry for himself, but one of the police officers thanks him. Bobby is unsure where he belongs. Should he be with his father, or with the New Mutants? Instead, he decides to go and see his mother in Rio de Janeiro. Back at the mansion, Sam and Danny arrive just in time to see the Beyonder arrive. Warlock is screaming that they must flee, but the Beyonder says there's no point. He's offered them transcendence, and they refused it, so he will punish them. Illyana gives herself up and begs him that only she should die, but the Beyonder just disintegrates her. The New Mutants fight back, but the Beyonder is winning, until they all work together. Finally, he is defeated, but the New Mutants aren't feeling victorious, they just feel sad. Danny lets them all know it can't be over, as the Beyonder is omnipotent, and they're just kids. And he rises up to have his turn. Quickly, he kills everyone but Danny. He asks her why she isn't running, but she knows there is no point. We never had a prayer. You could have finished us any time. Was it fun to taunt us with false hope? Something new for you to learn about being human. I'm wasting my breath. You don't care. You never did. We're nothing to you. She gets back on Brightwind, rides towards the Beyonder, and touches him, just as she is disintegrated by him. And with a wave of his hand, he becomes true to his word. In Colorado, William and Margaret Proudstar forget they ever had a daughter. In Manhattan, Roberto da Costa forgets his best friends. In Salem Center, Virgin Forest lines the shore of Breakstone Lake. Of Professor Xavier's school, of its youngest pupils, nothing remains. Not even memories. That's the end.
Life is a mystery. Everyone must stand.
Poetry there at the end, almost from Chris Claremont. Mm-hmm. He did like to write a bit poetically.
Mm.
So, this story, what was your reaction reading it? Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I did, yeah. I think it's probably one of those ones where, again, if you just come into it fresh, you don't really know who's who.
You definitely don't get everything. I mean, this was my first issue of New Mutants, and I didn't know these characters. I knew the X-Men. I'd read some X-Men comics.
Okay.
And I'd read some Marvel UK reprints of Power Pack stories.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them did feature Danny and Sam and Rain.
Okay.
So three of the characters. Mm-hmm. And actually involved her fighting death. So I knew that element. I knew that she could see death, that.
Mm.
And I knew who the Beyonder was as well. I'd read stories that featured the Beyonder.
Mm.
So maybe that helped as well.
Mm. Mm.
I wasn't coming in completely cold, but I was pretty cold.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, sometimes when we're talking about these comics, you know, I love them, but I never read them cold.
Right, right.
Because I was reading comics, you know, Marvel UK comics from about the age of 6 or 7. You know, I knew bits and bobs. I didn't read everything.
Mm.
But, you know, I'd read some Spider-Man. So you know some things, you know characters, you know a bit about how Marvel works.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose it wasn't entirely new.
No.
But a lot of this was new.
Right.
You know, I had no idea who Ileana was, who Karma was, who...
Yeah.
I mean, one thing, we talked about this before we came on air, and it's a weakness of Chris Claremont, and it's a famous weakness. He has a tendency to call all his characters by multiple different names.
Mm.
You know, it is something he does. And it's about realism. It's about the idea, I think, in his mind that, you know, different people call you different things.
Mm, mm,
mm. You know, if your name's David, you might be called Dave by some people. You might call Davey. You might be called David. Mm. You might be called Mr. Jones or whatever. Mm. You know, you will be called different things by different people. And he does this throughout the stories. And it does add realism, but it can be confusing if you're new.
Mm.
Where they have the characters, it's like, who is that?
Mm.
They're all wearing similar costumes. I think this might help more than some New Mutants, because actually they're all in their pajamas, really.
Mm. Mm.
Which makes them stand out from each other a bit more than when they're all in the identical costumes.
Mm. Mm.
You know, they're all lounging around watching a movie, which helps. I mean, I think definitely in the first couple of pages, you can tell they're different kinds of characters.
Mm.
And you see that, the kind of difference. And you mentioned specifically the bit where Danny sees the images of death above them.
Mm. Mm.
And they reveal a lot. So the first one she sees is over Ileana, and it's a demon.
Mm-hmm.
And what that's reflecting is that Ileana, you know, was kidnapped as a child. This is going to sound insane. I'm going to tell you the background of Ileana. Okay. She was kidnapped as a child and she was brought up in a demon dimension called Limbo. And she ended up being in charge of that when she came back.
Mm-hmm.
And she was disappeared for the X-Men. She disappeared for like 30 seconds or something. Okay. But for her, it was 7 years. So she's a teenager now.
Mm-hmm.
She had been a seven-year-old and she was brought up around demons.
Mm.
So her image of death is a demon.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have Sean Khoi Man, who's a Vietnamese refugee.
Okay.
And she's Catholic. That's established in the stories. So her image of death is an angel. And quite specifically, actually, I think it's quite an Old Testament angel. You know, kind of powerful looking, dramatic, very beautiful. Amara, very weird character. She's called Magma. She's the one with the power over the earth and kind of lava, that kind of powers. She is brought up, this makes no sense, but this is what happened in the comics. She is from a hidden Roman society in the Amazon.
Okay.
Obviously.
As you do.
Who still follow Roman tradition and rules, still dress like Romans. You can see that in her nightdress. It's got like a Roman toga effect. So her image is Pluto, Lord of the Olympian Underworld. And obviously, because it's Marvel Comics, there is an established look for that character, and that's what this character is following. That is the Pluto that appeared in, you know, Jack Kirby Thor comics.
Oh, okay.
The version of Pluto, the god of the underworld for the Romans.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she's got that. So you're getting revelations. Let's turn over the page. Look at the next. So we've got Rain. Rain has got somebody, I think it's another version of an angel, actually.
Okay.
But Rain is kind of Presbyterian. She's from, she was actually adopted and brought up by a Scottish pastor who's very kind of scary and thinks superpowers are a sign of the devil. So her Christianity is very kind of, it's kind of the Protestantism. So she's got a very formidable looking angel, almost militaristic looking, I think. I think there's a touch of Joan of Arc there. Yeah, with like a kind of Celtic cross behind her.
I'd have said that was more of a Nazi kind of.
Yeah, almost.
Teutonic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This really kind of muscular Christianity. Doug, who's just an ordinary American boy, he's actually the local boy. So he's from the area where the school is in New York.
Okay.
He's got a very traditional hooded death, you know, kind of Grim Reaper picture.
Yeah.
Warlock has an image of his father, Magus. So Warlock and Magus, they come from the, this sounds insane as well, they're from an alien race called the Technarchy.
Okay.
Or the Technarch, it's sometimes called. And they're a race. And what happens is within their race, the child, the warlock, has to battle the parent, the Magus. And whoever wins, then they become the Magus. You know, so they try to kill them. So he came to Earth trying to get away from his father who was chasing him. Warlock counts as a mutant because he has empathy, which normally people of his race don't have.
Okay.
So he has empathy for people. So he doesn't want to die. He doesn't want to fight his father. But the image of death for him is his father. And Sam, who's from the South, he's kind of got a Southern preacher character, I would say.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's got a touch of like the Clint Eastwood man with no name kind of thing.
Yeah.
Holding a Bible, maybe a mourner at a funeral as his image of death. So actually, just with those images, for those characters, you get a very strong idea of what kind of person they are. You know, their image of death reflects something about them. Even if you don't understand it, you said to me in advance you didn't really get what was above Warlock.
Yeah.
Because you don't know the thing about Magus and you don't know. But the idea that death is basically him but scarier.
Yeah.
You can get that. You know, Doug got the traditional view of death. Sam's is kind of influenced by the Western thing. Maybe the fact that they're watching a Western movie reflects that. You know, and then you get Danny. You know, she sees the Norse thing, but she's also Native American. And then you get the, you get a lot of backstory with her because of her grandfather telling her the story. Now, what I wanted to ask you about, actually, very specifically, about the grandfather's story. So he tells the story about, they actually use the word for it. It's called something like catching coo. With coo spelt like, you know, like a coo. Counting coo. So it's spelled C-O-U-P. He talks about that. I never realised this. At the time I read this comic, I would have been, I think I must have read it in 1986 or 87, based on where I got it before, because I know I got it before the issue that I bought off the stands, which was my first issue of New Mutants, which is quite a bit later. I think my first issue was about number 47, so about 10 issues later. I think I read this maybe early 1987. And I read it, and I've reread it. It's a favourite. I love this comic. It's virtually falling apart because it's been reread and reread and reread, as, you know, comics that are reread and reread and reread happens. And it wasn't until I heard another podcast discussing this issue many years ago that I got this Counting Coo thing, that he tells this story about, you know, the greatest Cheyenne warrior. And what he would do is he would just touch somebody just to show that he could have killed them, but he didn't have to kill them to prove it. And he compares this to the white man, the settlers coming in, who felt that they had to destroy the Native Americans. And they had to kill everyone they came across. So you're getting this contrast of, you know, there's this, it can be heroic, you can prove you're a great fighter just by touching someone. It doesn't matter if you don't destroy them. Now, I read it. I got that story. I got the fact that she was making that story. What I missed is on the last two pages, and I don't think it's blatantly obvious in the art, but in the last two pages, as she flies towards the Beyonder to be killed, she touches him. So the idea that's in here, and I'm sure this was intended, but I didn't realise for like 30 years or something, is that she has got that victory. She has done what her ancestors did. She has touched the person who's destroying for the sake of destruction. And she has won. And actually, the first panel on that last page that you're looking at, her hand is over a silhouette of him. And at that point, he almost no longer exists on the panel. He's shown entirely in silhouettes. Or entirely in shadow. Because it's not about him, it's about her, and they're making that point. But for some reason, I never saw that until someone else pointed it out. I'd read that story, I'd read, you know, the futile fight's worth it, you know, our ways are better than the white man's ways. I got that. And I think I probably got that they were linking her battle against the Beyonder to Native Americans versus white settlers. You know, the fact that they were completely outgunned, literally, they had guns. The Native Americans didn't have guns. But I don't think I got that she did the same thing. And it wasn't until years later that I read the stories that come after this. So this is issue 37. I think, is it 37 or 36? 37, I'm trying. The next issue I got was issue 47, 10 issues later. And in between, lots of other stuff has happened. And I didn't get all those fill-in issues for quite a while. And what I particularly didn't get for quite a while was kind of the end of this story. So issues 38, 39, 40. Took me years to get them. They were some of the last issues. I have a full run of New Mutants. It's one of the few I've got. The graphic novel that launches it, I've got issues 1 to issue 100 when it was cancelled. I have every issue, but amongst the last ones I got were 38, 39, 40. And the continuation of the story is that they all get resurrected in Secret Wars number 9, the last issue of that series, mm-hmm. by the Beyonder. But they're kind of, they're mindless. They've got their memories, but then they're a bit like zombies because they died and were resurrected and they've kind of lost their connection to themselves. Mm-hmm. And the only one who maintains her connection to her previous self is Danny. And the idea is it's because she got the victory.
Mm.
The others just died, she won, even though she died.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something I wasn't able to see for many, many, many years because I didn't quite understand what was meant to have happened on that last page.
Oh, okay.
I mean, did you get that on your first read or did you need me to explain that before you got
me? I needed you to explain that.
Yeah, I think we talked about that previously, didn't we?
Mm.
Yeah, even outside of the podcast. It was something that isn't blatant, but it's there.
Yes.
But that's something I can love about comics as well, when there's like a hidden thing. There's deeper meaning that's there and you can read into it, but it's not there, obviously.
No.
You know, and there's lots of little things like that within the story are there, but you don't know unless you've read the rest.
Mm.
But it doesn't necessarily harm. So the whole thing about he'd offered them transcendence and they'd rejected it.
Right.
That's the previous story. That's issue 36.
Right.
Which I hadn't read and didn't read for quite a while.
Mm.
Weirdly, issue 36, I actually got a Marvel UK reprint of it before I found the real issue. And when I read that, I realised, he gives powers. He removes the demon from Ileana. He says, you know, we can remove all your powers and make you, you know, better people. And it's almost like a religious thing.
Mm.
But I didn't need to know that to read this.
No.
No. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we want to cover about it. We haven't really talked very much about the artwork.
No.
And I think the artwork's very effective.
For me, I think there are a few good panes or a few good windows.
Panels, maybe?
Panels, that's the professional word. As I said to you, I like on page 3, and we've already discussed this, so we'd no need to go over it.
When they use the surprints, the red printing,
right,
to show the images of death, is very, very good. And so actually,
talk to me about surprinting.
Surprint is just a thing. If you were to go to the Fire and Water Network and listen to their Who's Who podcast, they talk about it a lot,
right?
But because it's something Who's Who used a lot, but it's where what they would do is they would draw a part of the page on a different piece of paper.
Usually
a translucent piece of paper.
Okay.
So you could see it through and they say, this bit we want published entirely red, entirely blue, entirely green.
Okay.
Whatever. They can pick a colour and it means there's no black lines. It's a part of the art that just appears in a solid colour. So it's got a different feeling.
Yeah, because I asked myself that question, how they, was the background colour the colour of the paper, and so because it looks a bit like, sort of like for old people, it looks a bit like a Xerox printing, sort of like, I mean, you remember those machines when we were young.
You're talking about they're not Xeroxes, are they?
No.
Those ones where it was quite often purple and white, and you, oh god, what are they called, where you kind of wound the handle. Even He's by, doing a mime of winding the handle, and I know what he means.
Even by the time we were kids, they were pretty
But it was quite often purple, wasn't it? It was kind of a purpley blue on white, because they used a particular kind of printing, and you had to write it on these special sheets where it came through. It is a similar thing to this. If you look at the original art from that, there will be usually a piece of tracing paper or something similar, with a separate drawing in black and white that's kind of stuck over it, and they say, we want this bit to be, or you should be like, they use colour codes for the colours. So red was 100R. So 100% red.
Okay, because I don't think you explained it very well. So just for me, because I'm a bit dense. they...
So the art's on a piece of paper. They draw it. It's penciled by Mary Wilshire. Then Tom Orzechowski working with Lois Bohalis. This time we'll put the letters over it.
Okay.
And then the inker, the finisher, Bill Sienkiewicz, goes over the art in ink.
Okay.
And when they're doing that, certain bits, instead of inking it on the original piece of paper that will be photographed with the black line.
Okay.
Some of it is photographed on a separate piece of paper. So they do that by putting tracing paper or something,
okay.
or sometimes vellum or some kind of transparency over the top.
Yeah.
And they ink that bit on a different piece of paper
mm-hmm.
so that when it's photographed by the printer,
mm-hmm.
they say, this bit doesn't appear on the black line at mm-hmm. all. It appears entirely on the red plate.
Okay.
So when they're... The colour, it's made up of a mix of three colours.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So it's red, blue and yellow. They have red, blue, yellow and blacks. So there's four plates.
Yeah.
So the black lines are on and the writing is on the black plate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on the original art. Then there's another plate which is created by what the colourist has given them.
Mm-hmm.
But also has these bits that are 100% red.
Mm-hmm.
But on that page, there'll be other bits of red because there's some red dots in the skin tone of Danny. Yeah. You know, there's Ileana's got pink on her outfit, so that will have some red in it. So, but those bits don't appear on the black. So in the original art, it's on a different sheet of paper, okay. effectively,
okay.
so that it can be entirely printed in that colour with no black.
Mm.
Yeah?
Yeah. Okay.
So that's how they do it. You know, okay. sometimes they would do very fancy things. And they're called, sometimes they're called surprints. You see that quite often. If you look at original art, you know, I like looking at those original art on Comic Art Fans. Mm. I love that website and just looking at original pages. I find that really fascinating. Quite often it'll say surprint and like a code for the colour on the page when that happens. Sometimes it's called a colour hold.
Right.
Because it's just one colour.
Okay.
So it's like a trick thing. And then on that page, they've done it with green for Hella. Because Hella wears green. And then on that panel, they've done it with the yellow for her arms coming out ghostly out in the mirror. So it's an effect that's used quite a lot. It's quite a common one in comics of the 80s. And earlier, you know, it's just a way of using the printing process to get a different effect. Mm. Quite popular... some artists use it more than others. It would be used a lot for things like dream sequences, kind of flashbacks, images in thought bubbles, ghosts, you know, that kind of thing. It's quite often used as well. They use it a lot for magma. They use it for her power.
Right.
So she's solid yellow, but she has like the red lines on her. And that's used a lot for her. And you do get issues where they clearly... that page has gone missing in the printer.
Right.
Because she hasn't got the swirly effects on her. She's just entirely yellow, which she's never meant to be. So, yeah, that's an interesting thing with the art. I think it's very interesting as well. One of the interesting things about the art for me is we talked about Mary Wilshire and Bill Sienkiewicz and how they're working together. And Mary Wilshire, she does a lot of comics. She does things like Barbie. She does humor comics. She does she does a lot of things with real people to an extent, much more than she does superheroes. The only superhero stuff she really does is these three issues of New Mutants. She does a couple of Power Pack things, but they're kids who are superheroes. And she does the Firestar Limited series. But if you read that series, there's very little superheroing in it. It's more, it's almost like a girl's comic and an old-fashioned romance comic or something. And she's better at drawing real people.
So I think on this...
Page, you're looking at what page there? Page eight. You mentioned that to me, The Crowd.
The Crowd, I thought, was very good.
And that is something she does people well. But also, so does Bill Sienkiewicz, and he's very good at getting people looking different. And at the bottom of that, you've got them all looking at the site. And Bobby's there, Bobby DaCosta, Sunspot. But you've also got a few bystanders. There's like an old man, an old woman. There's like a posher man, a young woman. and they all look different, and they've got the texture of real people. And I don't necessarily know if they were taken from photos. I don't think they were, because they've also got a certain cartoony aspect, but they're different to each other. And there is a tendency in comics to have similar looking people.
Yeah. Even in the bigger pane on that page 8, where you've got mostly the
crane on its side,
the crane on its side, but you can see the people in the crowd, or most of them are turning away, but you've still got the policeman.
And they've got elements of real life. You know, there's a reporter, there's a policeman, the woman with her back to her, you can see a hair clip in her hair.
Yeah.
It's quite an observed and realistic. I mean, even for it's quite a tight shot of a New York street, but there's buildings of different shapes that you can see bits of in the background. You know, there's elements there that make it feel real and lived in. And I think, I think I said something about, you know, she puts people in real places.
Yeah.
So even earlier on when the New Mutants are watching telly, you know, the way that they interact with the furniture, the way they're sat.
Yeah.
You know, the fact there aren't enough seats for them. So some of them are sat on the floor and one of them's on a blanket or a cushion. It's got a realism. It doesn't feel photo-referenced. But they react with things in a way that people do.
I would say that they feel slightly separate, though. I mean, and I'm... And the one that I'm drawn to, apart from the topless boy, is him. So, like, I don't...
Oh, Sam, where he's pretending to be a cowboy and shooting Ileana. Okay. That's what they're pretending. So he's kind of doing cartoony movements. And he does have a real cartoony look to him.
But it doesn't feel...
You think it feels like separate from the rest?
It feels a lot of separate kind of images, like...
Oh, I suppose so.
Stuff together apart from the two...
But, you know, I think the way that Rain and Doug are sat on the floor, you know, and she's got the bunny slippers and he's just wearing his, like, kind of pyjama bottoms... And they're watching a film.
Sort of feel...
And I think the way Sean is sat in that armchair. Yeah. It's very odd in comics to see people sat on armchairs the way that people do. People put their legs up on it. They relax.
And I feel sort of like, I mean, in a way, I think... Here, maybe, I think sort of like sometimes you don't get... what I'm trying to say. Weight very well. So, sort of like, I mean, so the two boys at the front.
She's not a boy, Rain is a girl, she's just got short hair.
Okay, those two at the front, they're sinking into the cushions, and you can see that with their, with the boy's bum. I'm not quite sure what's happening there. Is that a rug?
They're her bunny slippers, but I think there is a little green cushion below her as well. The pink is bunny slippers, I think.
Oh, okay. She's kind of.
And she's kind of got her legs kind of up sideways, but she pointed towards.
Oh, okay. And you can see bunnies, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Asian girl, sort of like on the sofa, there's real weight.
Maybe the way they finish that line, you know, the fact that, you know, Bill Sienkiewicz sometimes can go a bit abstract, and the fact that he's gone for a straight line there. Remove some of the reality of it.
Maybe.
But it also draws your eye that way towards Ileana, who's the focus of that panel.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting that you're seeing different stuff than I am in the same image.
Yeah.
You know, there's something very interesting about that. But, like, you turn the page there and Sian's, like, playing with her hair. She's holding it in her ponytail for a bit.
Yeah.
You know, the way I play with my hair when it's a bit longer. And I think there's... There's real, like, naturalism to some of it. But then it's insane. You know, there's mad things happening as well. And I think that's a very interesting juxtaposition. And I think a lot of that's coming from the juxtaposition of the penciler doing quite naturalistic, real stuff. and then the Inca being someone who's a lot more looking at abstraction and shape and texture. I was reading an article not long ago and someone was talking about how his art was almost specially designed in the 80s to be scratchy, so that when it went scratchy because of the poor quality printing, it looked on purpose. And I don't know how true that is. That was someone's opinion online. But I think there is an element of the scratchiness makes a kind of a... it turns what could be a negative, poor quality printing, into a positive. You know, it looks scratchy on purpose. And the scratchiness allows for a level of subtlety that maybe isn't there. But I do think one of my most interesting things for this, there is one page of this, which is the penultimate page, page 23, that is not inked by Bill Sienkiewicz.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know who it's inked by. I think it might even be inked by Mary Wilshire herself, but it's got a different texture.
Okay, yeah, yeah, I can see.
Yeah, and it's definitely inked by someone else. I don't know who. And to me, that's fascinating to see how it looks when she's not in, when someone else is inking it. And you can see the way that that helps you see the changes. If you hold that open so you see page 24 alongside it, we've got it kind of folded over the comic there. The different texture shows you what he's adding. You know, what's coming from her and what's coming from him. And I think that's very interesting. You know, that kind of texture. I think that's a really... I think they're a fantastic... kind of example of what you can do in comics. And that sometimes the best art comes out of two different people who work in different styles working together. You know, sometimes putting a contrasting artist with someone can work really well. You know, and many times throughout his career, Bill Sienkiewicz has been placed with pencillers whose work is very different to his. You know, often used to make somebody whose stuff might be considered a bit more kind of scare quotes boring, to give it more interest. It's something that's done quite often in his career and is quite interesting. But no, I think we've covered that. I think we've covered that. I think, you know, it was a comic that made me love some of these characters and made me interested in this book. We've not talked much about the villain, the Beyonder, but I don't think we need to, because he's not... he's significant to the story, but actually the story isn't about him.
He's a bit two-dimensional, maybe, in this one in this one issue. You don't really, unless... perhaps unless you've read the previous ones, you don't really understand.
I mean, what's quite interesting is the bit from the cover. It's a Secret Wars 2 crossover. Secret Wars 2 is about the Beyonder coming to Earth. And Secret Wars 2 is considered one of the worst things that Marvel published in the 80s. I think that may be slightly unfair, but it's flawed. It shows signs of... Secret Wars 2 was written by the editor-in-chief. And it was written by somebody who nobody could say no to. And it's a story that shouldn't have happened. There's elements to the story that shouldn't have happened. But if you listen to people, I mean, I would recommend to anyone, there is a podcast called Secret Wars and Beyond that is by... I've forgotten their names. Oh, God, I'm terrible. But you can find that. Search Secret Wars or Beyond, you can find it. And for Secret Wars 2, they covered every Secret Wars 2 issue, but also all of the crossovers. And when they were talking about the X-Men and New Mutants, there is no doubt they are the best part of that story. And that is because what Chris Claremont does very cleverly at this point is he uses the Beyonder as a catalyst to tell stories about his characters. And one thing that can happen with a crossover is you end up being overtaken by the overarching story. Now, the question becomes, did Chris Claremont get to do that because the best-selling Marvel comic book was X-Men? The second best-selling Marvel comic was New Mutants. was it the fact that he was working on the bestseller mean that he got to write stories that were about his characters that featured the Beyonder? You know, that he could go to the editor-in-chief and say, if I can tell my story, it'll make people interested to go and read your story. Whereas in other stories, there was heavy rewriting by Jim Shooter when the Beyonder was in them. And he was making writers tell stories they didn't want to tell. And you can tell that when you read them. And also from the interviews and stuff. So I wonder how much did Chris Claremont tell better stories because he could say no to Jim Shooter? Or did he tell better stories because he focused on the characters and everyone who was doing Secret Wars 2 crossovers could have chosen to do that? And he was the only one who did that. I don't know. And actually, the Beyonder isn't very important, even though he's very important in this story, which is interesting. It's an interesting way of doing a crossover. But I think I still love this comic. I think you're quite positive on it, would you say? Should I love this comic?
Yes, I think you should.
I think there's enough there. I think it's very well done for a crossover. And it does that thing where there's enough there for someone who's new, but you don't get everything.
Totally, yeah.
And actually, if you got everything, maybe it wouldn't make you come back. The fact that there's some intrigue, it's like, oh, what's going on with this character? What's happening here? What's happening here? Maybe makes you want to come back more than if everything was an open book. I don't know. It's hard to judge that. So we've decided, should I love this comic? Yes, I should. Now, we will be back, hopefully very soon. I'm hoping to do it in 2 weeks. We're actually going to do a special project next.
We are.
And what we're going to do is we're going to do a series within a series called Should I Love This Era, where we're going to look at all the Marvel Universe comics that were released in 1 month by Marvel, and it's the 25th anniversary month. It's the ones that are cover dated November 1986, which are the ones that have the very special kind of 25th anniversary border on them. And we're going to look at all those. And that was my second month of buying new Marvel US comics. And it was, for most of the Marvel books, it was my first issue that I bought. Because the previous month, all I'd bought in the previous month was X-Factor, and I think it was just X-Factor, actually. I'd bought X-Factor. And then with the following month, I saw them all. I got there early enough in the month, but over the month, I pretty much got them all. And by now, I have them all. I've read every single one of those issues. So we're going to review them all. We're going to start with Fantastic Four, which is the series that's having its 25th anniversary. So our next episode, episode 10 of Should I Love This Comic, will be the first part of Should I Love This Era, looking at the Marvel 25th anniversary, which will come out in 2 weeks' time, hopefully. So we are looking at mid-April for that. And then every 2 weeks from then on, we will do a series of looking at all those Marvel comics from November 1986. So on that note, I'm going to say goodbye. So bye-bye, everyone.
Goodbye. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. Yes, it'll still be very soon after Easter by the time this is released. Happy Thank you very Easter. Much.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye. It's meant to be love, not lie.
Oh, okay, sorry. Try again.
Yes. Welcome to Should I Love This Guy? You said like again. For fuck's sake! But probably a lot of this can be deleted.
Mm.
New Mutants is a spin-off series featuring cows.